The Church of God the Eternal presents The Exploitation of Social Issues. Of this subtopic entitled, What is the Godly Work Ethic? This is the number 4 tape and will be given by Mr. Raymond Cole.
All right, we started this one, which was supposed to be foundational. And it is interesting, God himself is extremely foundational. So I think when I evaluated all the subject material involved in this matter of social issues, the things that are going to come to the surface in the last days, or are coming to the surface now, even at this very time, all of them distinctly relate to this foundational subject which I want to give to you, and that is, what is a godly work ethic? Without understanding that, we're not going to understand a lot of issues. And I mean a lot of issues. Things that may, on the surface, appear to be completely unrelated. But I think you're going to see, when we get on down through it, how distinctly related they are. So, we started off with this matter of what man is, then the responsibilities that God gave to him as a father, work, and how we're to carry out that work, the charge that God gave to us concerning our own domain, which is this earth, and God said, I want you to take care of it. Now, obviously, no single human being can take care of the whole earth. So therefore, the specific instruction which God said concerning the earth, that I want you to prune it and to take care of it, must be a combined responsibility. Can you imagine some man being given the responsibility of pruning and taking care of the entire earth? I'll tell you, he'd have his work cut out. And I'm not sure that he'd ever get back around to taking care of the first part that he took care of 3,000 or 4,000 years ago. Because he would never make it. Take a long, long time. So obviously, it is a combined responsibility. The Bible speaks not only in a personal, but a combined area. So we do have then, as man created by God, as the children of God, a distinct responsibility of taking care of our domain. Now, how then would we take care of it in a combined fashion? Merely by each one of us taking care of that which is his domain. So we are talking about individual responsibilities that add up to a collective responsibility. But as we noticed, man with a responsive mind, or a very fertile mind, was responsive to different advice. We don't always want to hear what God has to say. We'd like to hear things that seem to be more palatable and acceptable. And men have been very quick to respond to the subtle innuendo of Satan and of those who actively and aggressively pursue his philosophy and way of life. So man with his fertile mind has listened very carefully to information, to counsel that was very unwise. And what were the conditions then of the work which resulted from the pursuit of that bad advice? We wound up with a responsibility that God did not take away from us, but only added then tenuous areas that adversely affect us in carrying out that responsibility. Now we have inclement weather. We have a lot of weeds that grow. We have a lot of illogical behavior that crops up, weeds of mind. And they all adversely affect us, don't they? But God didn't take away the responsibility at all. He said, I still require you to get it done. But now you've just made it more difficult, so you're going to have to do it under the pain of curse. And so as we set about our work, taking care of our responsibilities in life today, we find we have to do it with sore joints and sore shoulders and sore feet and and whatever else can get sore. And yet we still have to get out and get it done. Because there is no lifting of that responsibility whatsoever. And yet God requires us to do it. So, we found then that there are conditions of work which resulted from this negative response to the subtle innuendo, the subtle advice that either stemmed from that which we have conceived in our own minds or that which we have heard because it was pleasing to our hearing. Now, we're all under the hearing. There are many, many times that people say, especially youth when it grows up, well, I'm not converted. Well, what's that supposed to mean? You still heard it. And you're still required to do it. Being unconverted is not a license. It's only the pursuit of bad advice. When we do those things that are not pleasing and acceptable in the sight of God. If somebody says, well, I'm not converted, therefore I don't have to keep the Sabbath. Who said that? Where in all the Bible does it say the unconverted don't have to keep the Sabbath? The only thing I find in there is the unconverted won't do it because they're defiant and rebellious. It's not a license. Let's quit deceiving ourselves. The responsibility is still incumbent upon us. And if we say, well, I don't know or I don't accept that, that's relatively immaterial also. You better take time and get the Bible down and read it. And find out what it says. God did not require of ancient Israel that which they could not have done. They could have lived it to the letter. And that's all he required of them. Even the letter obedience won't get you in the kingdom. No, God has to add the spiritual dimension when he calls. But nonetheless, God does require physical obedience regardless of whom we are, where and when we live, and regardless of the conditions or the circumstances. It doesn't make any difference. But we must live up to them. And we should not be looking for avenues around it. And above all, don't delude yourself by saying, I'm unconverted. Deceiving and being deceived. And it isn't going to get anybody anyplace. All right, it's very, very important that we keep that principle in mind concerning the conditions and the times and the circumstances under which we live. Because time is fast fleeing. And it's going to be absolutely necessary for us to give an account to God. That's right, an account to God. And I wonder how well we're going to be able to do it on down the road. I don't pick on anybody individually. But I will not mince any words when it comes to the principles. I'm going to lay them down. And all of you who were here from the beginning will well remember that I said we were going to abide by those principles. I am going to preach them, and I'm going to preach them powerfully. It's a matter of your action from there on. So we understand that there are conditions. There are trying conditions out there. And regardless of that condition, those trying circumstances, we are obligated to manifest a certain spirit and a certain attitude. We went through that, if you will remember, last time. And then God promises to the faithful. No promise in all the Bible that God says he's going to remove all of those negative curses that befell mankind. I don't care if you pray 3 times a day, if you fast twice a week, and if you do everything God requires of you perfectly, you are still going to work with pain and with suffering. that befell man as a general curse for his disobedience. And you and I are going to live life in that set of circumstances. And we are obligated by God Himself to work regardless of those conditions and those circumstances. Now, we could have had it differently, but men didn't want that. So, curses befell them. All right, now, since patience is necessary, we've got to recognize our own liabilities, our own faux pas, our own problems. And they're inevitable. We must therefore recognize on that basis that despite all of those conditions and all of those circumstances, there is still only one acceptable objective for work. Let's see if we can begin to understand what it is. Back here in Genesis 2. The Lord God took the man and put him into the Garden of Eden to dress it and to keep it. But all men aren't gardeners. And our whole relationship, that is work relationship, has changed down to the present time. What is then the underlying principle in this verse? The only objective for any work which we do, and I mean the only objective, is to make it a matter of service, not only to ourselves and to mankind and to our families, but to mankind. It is the care of a responsibility. And we're going to see when we get on down through some other texts that the only work which is acceptable in the sight of God is that which renders a service. You see, there are two things that we can do in work. Two things that we can do in the work that we perform. We can either render a service to humanity. It is a basic philosophy by which we labor and serve and give our vitality, our energy, or we can make it personally accumulative. In other words, we only do it for self-satisfaction. We're laboring to take care of the empirical self, you individually, and maybe a family or whatever. That's not acceptable. It never has been. What we are obligated to do is render a service that, when united with the other fellow who renders a service, and they in turn are united with others who are rendering a service, then will be a service to all mankind. It's a benefit. Now, when we evaluate what we're doing, does it render a service to human beings? Or is it exploitive? Are we merely taking advantage? Or are we giving ourselves as servants? So the objective then is, having been placed in charge of a family, in charge of a domain, in charge of whatever it is, God says, take care of it. Dress it and keep it. And when we all do it, we unitedly then take care of the total charge that God gave to mankind. Now, let's notice in this context something the Apostle Paul said over here in 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians, the 7th chapter, and I want to notice verse 31. 1 Corinthians 7, and let's note verse 31. And they that use this world as not abusing it, for the fashion of this world passes away. Now, God made a society here, a world. Let's call it our ecological world. In balance. Ready for the habitation of man. It had to be recreated and made habitable by man. And God said, I want you to take care of it now. Because the fashion of this world is going to pass away. You see, the structure of our atmosphere, the structure of an envelope of air and the exchange, you know, of the chemistry in the structure of this earth is all here for the benefit of mankind. You can't live on any of the others. And scientists are eventually going to find that out. Although they keep thinking there must be life here or there or someplace. But human beings aren't going to live there. I don't care what kind of life is out there. God made the earth into a favorable habitation for man. And he said, this is ultimately going to pass away. Because it's going to be burned up and it's going to be refined. Once the human experiment is completed. That's all there is to it. Then there is no longer any necessity for something where human beings can live. That's what Paul said. Notice it. And they that use this world, using all the powers and the capabilities that exist within this earth, but not to abuse them. It means using them. Because God is judging us, and by which we're going to be evaluated in how we're going to use a different domain later on, by how we use this one. He said, don't abuse it. Are we abusing the surface of this earth? Oh, many, many areas, many industries are exploiting and taking terrible advantage. But I'll tell you, it's a whole lot broader than what we realize. They've been spraying insecticides for who knows how long, but they have also been dumping out fertilizers by the millions of tons that have not been utilizing the force, the strength, and the viability of our land. But they have been doing what is commonly believed to be exactly what Cain did. He forced the land. And the sin of Cain. So we've been forcing the land. And it's not acceptable in the sight of God. Somebody's going to pay a price. So we find they that use this world. Now, how in the world do you use the world? You employ its forces, its strengths, and the set of circumstances that are extant, using them, but not abusing them. It is interesting that the word abuse used a number of areas, but let me turn to the Living Translation here. I want to turn now to this same text here in 1 Corinthians, the 7th chapter, verse 31, and read it from the Living Bible. Beginning here in verse 29, it says, the important thing to remember is that our remaining time is very short, and so are our opportunities for doing the Lord's work. For that reason, those who have wives should stay as free as possible for the Lord. Happiness or sadness or wealth should not keep anyone from doing God's work. Those in frequent contact with the exciting things the world offers should make good use of their opportunities without stopping to enjoy them. for the world in its present form will soon be gone. So what he is saying is, pardon me, the whole of this earth has been put here not for man's simple pleasure. And there are too many people that believe the only thing that counts is what they can derive out of it as a satisfaction or a pleasure. And that is not the case. It's been put here to be constructively used. And we're going to see for what reason as we go on. So we find then in 1 Corinthians 7 that we're supposed to use this world, but not to abuse it, not to take any advantage whatsoever. No way should we exploit. And exploitation is always that second orientation in our work. Remember, I said there are only two avenues. You either serve, you render a service for mankind and thereby derive a benefit yourself, or else you take advantage and exploit. It's only for your personal satisfaction. The one is not acceptable in the sight of God. Now, when you understand that, you're going to begin to understand the problem with many of these social difficulties. So I do not want you to lose track of it. We're not here to restructure, to remake anything on the basis of man's dictates. We must first understand that we were put here for purpose. And God gave us a favorable nesting area, a set of circumstances. And he said, now wisely use them. Don't take any advantage. Don't exploit or abuse. I'm not going to talk about that further at this point because we're going to pick up many of these things in specific areas later on. Now let's notice the example of Christ. The example of Christ. You couldn't get a better example back here in Matthew the 20th chapter. And I know that there will be people who say, well, that's the ministry. Well, you mean the ministry is any different than anybody else? The answer is no. So we find here the condition or the circumstance that controlled the activity of Jesus Christ. Here in Matthew the 20th chapter, and let's begin in verse 20. Then came to him the mother of Zebedee's children with her sons, worshiping him and desiring a certain thing of him. Now what was it that she wanted? And he said unto her, what wilt thou? What is it that you have in your mind? She said unto him, grant that these my two sons may sit the one on the right hand and the other on the left in your kingdom. Now, what was it that she really wanted? Personal recognition. She could get her two sons in there by hook or by crook. It would have been very rewarding and very satisfying to her. But in order to get her two sons in there, she had to have total disregard for everyone else, didn't she? She wasn't even going to be happy with 50-50. She wanted one on one side and the other one on the other side. And so in order to satisfy some kind of a quirk in her thinking, she was willing to trample on all the remaining millions of people on the face of the earth. I don't care what happens to them. I just want my two sons there. Exploitation to the nth degree. You know, it would have been an amazing gesture on her part if she had said, well, no, I don't want them there, and I wouldn't want to be there myself, but I want to be where I can best serve humanity. But is that what people think? No, that's not natural. Not natural at all. Because our own wants so vastly exceed what we might desire spiritually. We want what we want. And then we hope that somehow we can make it fit into those things that are acceptable in the sight of God. Remember, the Apostle Paul gave the illustration back there of exploitation as one who took a wife. Because the party wanted a wife and did not want to really serve God. Because they did not weigh the times. I didn't write it, Paul did. He said we should definitely think in terms of the circumstances and how we best serve. Is that saying that marrying is wrong? No, absolutely not. But for what reason? What reason? Okay, so here now was the end product of a marriage. Couple of boys, young men. Now, by extension, she wanted her children to gain this dominance, this position. And so, what did Jesus Christ say? But Jesus answered her and said, "You don't even know what you ask." Now, why would he make a statement like that? Well, because she didn't. When it came to spiritual things, she had no grasp whatsoever at that moment. "You don't even know what you ask. Are you able to drink of the cup that I shall drink of?" In other words, will you be a total sacrifice? I mean, are you ready and willing to give up everything? Or is this merely the fulfillment of some carnal aspiration and hope for recognition or glory? Is that why you want it? Or because you want to be the ultimate sacrifice for purpose? But Jesus answered and said, "You know not what you ask. Are you able to drink of the cup that I shall drink of and to be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with?" Just like human beings. Notice now. And they said unto him, "We're able. Our mouths can get us in so fast that it's pitiful," but they didn't even know what they were asking for. But there wasn't any question in their minds. They were ready to do anything that Christ wanted them to do. They knew that. Why, I know several million people that will tell me exactly the same thing today. Until you zero in onto a factor, a specific factor. Oh, but that's no. Don't ever be specific about it. Just let it be broad and general so that you can delude yourself into any conception you want to. Then it's all right. Then we've got all the avenue in which to play and delude ourselves. Brethren, what I'm talking about is deceiving and being deceived. It's awfully easy for us to do it unless we weigh seriously those responsibilities. They said unto him, "Sure, we're able." And he said unto them, "You shall drink indeed of my cup." Now, he didn't tell them that, he didn't pat them on the back for their success and their accomplishment. Not at all. Notice what he said. Well, whether you know or understand or whether you don't, you're going to get it. So he said unto them, "You shall drink indeed of my cup and be baptized with the baptism that I'm baptized with." And what does it mean? What was it they went through? The most horrendous set of experiences any human being could go through. According to tradition, with the exception of the Apostle John, every one of the apostles was martyred. They paid dearly with their lives to serve a few people, most of whom were turned out to be renegades anyway. Oh, there were a few of them that remained faithful, But in the final analysis, the Bible tells us very clearly the vast majority turned away. And he said, few there be that find it, which is indeed true. You shall drink indeed of my cup and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with, but to sit on my right hand and on my left is not mine to give. But it shall be given to them for whom it is prepared of my Father. And God hasn't told us. And when the ten heard it, oh, now this is characteristic too. Here they were, the chosen servants of God. And the ten heard it, they were moved with indignation. Why, those so-and-sos trying to get out, get in ahead of us against the two brethren. Now I want you to notice a cardinal principle. This is what we're coming to. Jesus called them unto him. He said, come on now. I want you to understand something that's vitally important. And said, you know that the princes of the Gentiles exercise dominion over them. What in the world did Christ think he was doing? Did he think that the disciples wanted to be a bunch of Gentile rulers? Why, those disciples would have told him 1,000 times over that they didn't want any of that. The only thing is, Christ reads hearts. And he knew immediately that the only reason for that was that they wanted preeminence. And they didn't want somebody else ruling over them. So he said, don't you know that the princes of the Gentiles exercise dominion over them? They wanted a position where they had authority and control and nobody over them. That's what they were after. And they that are a great exercise authority upon them. But it shall not be so among you. It shall not be so among you. But whosoever will be great among you, let him be your servant. The word minister is simply the word in the New Testament that means servant. You want to be great? Two things to do. Zip the mouth shut. Don't ever broadcast or say anything. And number two, just get out there and serve everyone with everything that's within you. And you will be great sometime. Now that's what God says is required as a work objective, a work ethic. It had better be a matter of service. The ministry is only one responsibility in life. Any other thing we do had better be to the betterment of man, to the betterment of our community, as a service to humankind. So the only real objective for work is service. The only purpose for the accrual of any power in life is to serve. That's the only reason. And God is going to weigh us in due time on that basis. So Christ is our example then. And we must be ready to serve. I don't mean for glory. Notice what they wanted it for that very reason. They wanted to sit there and exercise authority over somebody. Recognition and authority over others so that they wouldn't have authority over them. But he said, it shall not be so among you. And if it is true in that area, it is true in every other area. We want to serve. So the greater the responsibility you are given, the greater challenges of service. That's why you have it. The more authority and more responsibility you are given, the more service you are to render. That's why you have it. If you're going to carry out a charge in life, the greater the responsibility given to you, the more God is going to expect service from you. That must be our M.O. Now, in John 9 and verse 4, we amplify just a little on this. John 9 and verse 4. As an example of Christ, as a work of service. And notice what he said here in verse 4. I must work the works of him that sent me. It doesn't sound to me like he was going to do his own thing. What did he say? I must work the works of him that sent me. While it is day, the night comes when no man can work. What are the works of God who sent us, who has called us, who has commissioned us? We all bear certain responsibility. What is our call? What is our mission? And how are we upholding our responsibility? Now, next, the effort and the direction must be according to the will of God. That's why we have the Bible. So that we, understanding that we are rendering a service as though we were doing it directly to Christ, must ask, how would Christ do it? What does he want me to do? How does he want me to carry out the responsibility? For any duty that we are given within the framework of those of us who are called is a service rendered to Christ. And in the first place, if we are what we ought to be, the old self is dead and the new one is alive, which is Christ within us. Now, how would Christ do it? Would he slough off? Would he be indifferent about responsibility? Or would his be a service? Always, always oriented by the concept of service. So the effort and the direction must always be according to the will of God, what Christ would do. In Colossians 2, and I'm going to read from the Living Translation once again, Colossians, the second chapter, and let's begin in verse 20. Colossians 2, and we're going to begin in verse 20. A text that I am sure most just read right over, because it is a little bit ambiguous and difficult to grasp or to understand, but let's see if we can't pick up a few thoughts out of it. Here in Colossians 2 and beginning in verse 20, he said, since you died, as it were, with Christ, and this has set you free from following the world's ideas of how to be saved. Well, let's forget, you know, Taylor does sometimes go off in wild extremes. And indeed, maybe he's right, you know, in this case, and we'll just say that he's part of it. The world's ideas of how to be saved, by doing good and obeying various rules. In other words, do this and do that and so on, you know, and his interpretation of what's... Let me get it here, so I'll switch back and forth between the two. Touch not, handle not, and so on. Here in 2 and beginning in verse 20, wherefore, if you be dead with Christ from the rudiments of the world, why, as though living in the world, are you subject to ordinances? Touch not, taste not, handle not, which all are to perish with the using. So here now, he is relating this to a set of physical circumstances. Now let's go back and see if we can pick it up from... So we can get the basic understanding of its context here in the Living Bible. Since you died, as it were, with Christ, and this has set you free from following the world's ideas of how to be saved. Well, that's iffy. By doing good and obeying various rules, why do you keep right on following them anyway? still bound by such rules as not eating, tasting, or even touching certain foods. Such rules are mere human teachings, for food was made to be eaten and used up. But you see, what was going on technically was the fact that there was this old concept that if they avoided certain foods or if they put themselves through the grist mill by, very, very stringent control in their lives, this was a proof of their character. And it is a common practice among many, many of the pagans, and is still a very definite practice among many religions today, that they'll make major sacrifices. Well, they were carrying this right on into the church itself. And so he said, such rules are mere human teachings, for food was made to be eaten and used up. So the physical things were made to be used, but not abused. They were made to be used acceptably. But I wonder to what extent have we, because we have been deceived by the great manufacturing concerns of the world, how many of us have been deceived into believing that what men have fabricated is better than what God created? Better weigh that one very carefully. For food was made to be eaten and used up. Now, obviously, if we do not abuse that food and we leave it natural as God created it. I didn't say you couldn't cook it. What I'm talking about is tearing, ripping the thing down. We refabricate it, reconstitute it. We do everything in the book. And then we hand it back as food. After we've gotten finished with it, manufacturing concerns have gotten finished with it, and they have made about 10 different products so they can make 10 times as much money out of it. Are they worrying about serving you, or is this indeed an area of exploitation? Oh, I told you it was going to involve a lot of areas. So sometimes we may need to look right down into what we're doing and see, is it exploitive or is it a service? Such rules are mere human teachings, for food was made to be eaten and used up. These rules may seem good, for rules of this kind require strong devotion and are humiliating and hard on the body. It does show an element of control, Paul said. But not very wise usage. But they have no effect when it comes to conquering a person's evil thoughts and desires. They only make him proud. In other words, when we effectively hold true to certain conceptions of our own, it tends to create an element of pride. And many people are filled with pride in many of those areas. Oh, I won't give you the examples. There are thousands of them, where people have clung to certain conceptions and certain ideas, and they have bowed before their own wills. People in this world oftentimes can do it. And there is a certain element of pride and satisfaction that goes with that. But it has no value whatsoever in the mastery of the self. So God said in this case that we can set out to achieve all kinds of things. We can use willpower to do certain things, but they may not be acceptable. They may be wrong. And if they are wrong, they are going to be of no value whatsoever to us. So we must be sure that what we're pursuing is right. People have done strange, amazing things in this world in the interest of other religions. The Oriental religions especially. But does that mean they have any value? No. They're all going to pass. with no end results which are good. Proverbs 16 and verse 3. Proverbs 16 and noting verse 3. Commit thy works unto the Lord, and thy thoughts shall be established. He said, don't assume. Commit thy works unto the Lord, and then your thoughts shall be established. So we need to commit our ways to God, our efforts, our endeavors, the things that we are doing. And we need to ask ourselves the basic questions that I have posed. For what reason? Is it a service? Or is it exploitive? Hebrews 13 and verse 21. Hebrews 13, and let's note verse 21. Make you perfect in every good work to do his will. Make you perfect in every good work to do his will. Working in you that which is well pleasing in his sight through Jesus Christ, to whom be glory forever and ever. So let's make sure that if Christ is living within us, that we are not going contrary to the will of Christ. And let's never accuse Christ of being schizophrenic. Because sometimes Christ is not backing us up in the things that we do. Is it always in accord with the will of Christ? Is it an act of service? And we're thinking of the people who are going to be the gift of our service on down the road. And being conscious of that, we want to render the best. Now, next, work must have purpose beyond its own inherent worth. Its own inherent worth means that we made a living or a salary out of it. But it's got to be a lot more than that. What if God had performed his work on that very basis? I'm not going to do anything that doesn't derive to my own personal satisfaction. Where would you be? God so loved the world that he made a major sacrifice for it. He gave up his son. Is our love made apparent, manifested in our actions, the work that we do for others? Are we conscious and aware of our obligation to serve? And that we are not in any way exploitive? In Micah, the 5th chapter, let's turn back to Micah. We find some interesting thoughts here. Micah, the 5th chapter, and let's begin in verse 11. And I will cut off the cities of the land and throw down all thy strongholds. And I will cut off witchcrafts out of thine hand. And thou shalt have no more soothsayers. So God is going to eliminate a lot of things. Thy graven images also will I cut off, and thy standing images out of the midst of thee. And thou shalt no more worship the work of thine hands. Can you imagine how many years we could have been working on the very things that God is going to eliminate? And thou shalt no more worship the work of thine hands. And I will pluck up thy groves out of the midst of thee, so will I destroy thy cities. And I will execute vengeance and anger and fury upon the heathen, such as they have not heard. There are things that are constructed and done today that are destined for destruction. Will we sustain a loss? We very easily could. But we need to weigh and be very convinced that what we're doing is pleasing and acceptable in the sight of God. If now, when you do something, whatever your work is, and I don't want to get caught in the old catchphrase, you know, that Sheldon developed, you know, where it says he walk in his footsteps, you know, or walk in his steps. You always ask the question, well, now, how would Christ do it? Well, I don't want to get caught up in that whatsoever, but I do want us to recognize that everything we do should be subject to that basic question. After all, who is supposedly living in you? Or do you leave him at home when you go to work? And then you only pick it up when you come back home in the evening. Or you go to church. Or is he supposed to be living within you day in and day out? In 1 Corinthians 3 now, and I want to conclude this very quickly. 1 Corinthians 3, in this matter of work. And let's begin in verse 13. He says, every man's work shall be made manifest, for the day will declare it. Because it shall be revealed by fire, and the fire shall try every man's work of what sort it is. If any man's work abide which he hath built thereon, he shall receive a reward. If any man's work shall be burned, he shall suffer loss. But he himself shall be saved, yet so as by fire. That is, by the trial that he's going to experience, because God is going to bring him around by virtue of those trials. The word fire here does not mean literal fire, but the fire of tribulation. It's going to bring us around. And so, where will our work stand? How will it stand in the sight of God in that day? I don't care whether it's in the ministry or whether it is in some responsibility in this world. They're both subject to test. Where will our work stand? I know if we have made sure that it is in accord with the principles of God, and it is an act of service rather than exploitive. Next time, we're going to pick up a little more of these basic principles on this matter of the work ethic.
The Church of God the Eternal has just presented The Exploitation of Social Issues. Of this subtopic entitled, What is the Godly Work Ethic? This was the number 4 tape, and it was given by Mr. Raymond Cole.